Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, he's just a guy made of dots and lines. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hey, guys.
Hey, Joe.
How you doing today?
I'm out of this world.
Oh, I see what you did there. We're talking today about Orion.
The spacecraft.
Not the
constellation.
Right.
Though someone might be led to believe the constellation, because I think you were just talking about connecting dots and...
And lines, maybe. That might have been a song about it. Well,
what is the Orion spacecraft?
Okay.
Because I saw some people going nuts about it on the internet the other day.
Yeah, yeah. And, including coworkers.
Absolutely. Well, okay.
Including
so,
myself.
You saw yourself. It was an out-of-body experience. On Friday, December 5th, 2014, at 7.05 a.m., the Orion Exploration Flight Test 1 launched from Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida.
Yeah, this was an important step in a very long and winding, I would say road, but really spacecraft don't take those that often.
Well, and this particular test flight was not a very long and winding road, was it? I mean, where it didn't go out to Jupiter or something.
No, it circled the Earth twice and then splashed down in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Baja California at a mere 4 hours later at 11:29 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Right.
So
I was so excited to watch that. I was actually watching it live streaming. I was feigning my ignorance.
I was talking about it on camera without being able to actually watch it.
Aww.
Oh, that's
Aww.
So sad.
Yeah, I knew it had been successfully launched, but I had not been able to actually watch it.
That's the futurist equivalent of being a sad clown.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Talking about
like you can't watch the present because you're talking about the future.
Yeah, that was kind of where I was going with that. I also like to have my portrait on velvet. It's just a thing I like.
Well, anyway,
yeah.
This test flight I thought was really inspiring and exciting. And you might be asking, what's the big deal? They were just flying some space vehicle. It wasn't like there was anybody in it.
Right. Well, to know what the big deal is, you got to know some history.
Okay.
So
we got to back up and then we'll get to the big deal.
Right. So December 19th, 1972 was a momentous day, an important day in the world's space exploration work. It was the day when the Apollo 17 spacecraft splashed down in the Pacific. Now, this marked the end of a mission that sent astronauts to the moon. Those astronauts being John Young, Charles Duke Jr., and Stuart Roosa. And they were the last human beings to ever go beyond low Earth orbit.
That's right. So not just the last human beings to go to the moon so far, but the last to go more than a few hundred miles beyond the surface of the Earth.
Oh, well, let's talk about what low Earth orbit means, because it's terminology that isn't, I mean, like orbit is pretty high.
Right.
Right.
And also just the fact that, you know, things like definitions like space, outer space, where does that begin? They all get a little fuzzy because there's not like a sign. And if you pass a certain point, the sign says, welcome to outer space. but these are the designations we have given specific areas of orbit around the Earth. So low Earth orbit, that's where a lot of our space stuff is, like the International Space Station, the Hubble Space Telescope. These are all in low Earth orbit. They're not further out. And that ends at about 2,000 kilometers out from the surface of the Earth, so 1,243.7 miles.
I always forget how close exactly the International Space Station really is. It's only a mere 431 kilometers, a.k.a. 268 miles above the surface of the Earth.
Yeah, it's close enough where you can actually see it when it passes overhead.
Yeah, it's very close, especially at a zoomed out view. If you were to step way back from the Earth and look, it's sort of like in the upper sky.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that how close it is, relatively speaking. Next, we have the medium Earth orbit. Because if you have low Earth orbit, there's got to be something else, right? There's got to be some other designation. Medium Earth orbit extends out to 35,786 kilometers or 22,236 miles. So from 2,000 kilometers to 35,786, that's medium Earth orbit. We're talking about a much larger area than low Earth orbit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to notice that every time we go a little further out, the actual area that we designate gets larger.
So is this where you would find geosynchronous satellites?
Exactly. This is where satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit inhabit. And those were placed there by unmanned missions. It's not like we flew some spacecraft out there, astronauts popped out, plopped a satellite into geosynchronous orbit, said, all right, good work, boys. Let's go on home. Clock out. That's not the way that works. Further out from there, you have high Earth orbit, which goes way, way out where, you know, including things like the moon, which is 384,400 kilometers or 238,900 miles away from the surface of the Earth. So that's, you know, a really good jaunt. And like we said, space shuttle program only stayed in low Earth orbit, never went beyond it. Only 24 human beings have ever been beyond low Earth orbit. And those are the people who were in the Apollo program.
Now, this is kind of weird if you're a space enthusiast and you don't often consider the fact, but it has been more than 40 years since humans went beyond. I think the farthest they've been since the end of the Apollo program was to service the Hubble Space Telescope.
I think you might be right on that.
I could be wrong if you're a NASA geek out there with awesome knowledge about anybody went a little bit farther than that, but definitely no one's been beyond low Earth orbit.
Right.
We have stayed really, really close to the surface of the Earth for more than 40 years.
Well, humans have.
Yeah. Yeah. And the question.
Oh, yeah, of course. We meanwhile have Voyager leaving the solar system.
Right.
Right. Just saying.
Although it took us like six or seven tries to say, okay, Voyager's left the solar system.
Now Voyager left the solar system 2 years ago.
Right, exactly. That is the best part, right? The best part is like, okay, we can now confirm for a fact that 2 years ago. But the interesting thing to me is that imagine that, you know, none of us were alive when the Apollo missions went to the moon. Even me. Despite what you're going to hear in a future podcast, I was not alive in 1972. But can you imagine if you were alive during that era where we were sending missions to the moon and sent multiple missions to the moon, that would you imagine that for the next four decades we wouldn't send anyone further out? That seems like that was going backward.
Yeah, it's like we've retreated from battle with space.
Yeah. Space
is winning.
Right. Space slapped us around a little bit, and we said, you know what? We need to figure this out before we try it again. And, you know, there are definite conversations to have, like whether or not manned space exploration is a real benefit compared to something like the robotics approach. All of those conversations we have had multiple times on this podcast. We just want to talk about the new approach to once again go beyond low Earth orbit. And that's what the Orion spacecraft is all about.
Right. So the big deal is this is how human beings are going to get way the heck out there in the future.
Yeah.
At least the ones who are going on NASA's dime.
Right. Yeah. It's this and listening to Timothy Leary. So as an overview of the Orion crew vehicle project, you actually need to go back a little bit too, because it kind of evolved over time.
Yeah.
So in the mid-2000s, that's when NASA unveiled a proposal for a continued human exploration of space, originally called the Vision for Space Exploration. This was a big thing during George W. Bush's administration. It was really inspiring. It was this very ambitious plan. And then there was a change of leadership at NASA, and it became even more ambitious. It became it was renamed into the Constellation Project. And as a part of that renaming, they also decided to rename the crew exploration vehicle and call it Orion.
The crew exploration vehicle, I don't believe we said, but that was the name that the shuttle was going to have.
Yeah. Well, it's named a spacecraft.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but exactly, that's what it was going to be, the crew exploration vehicle. Now it's called Orion. Because again, Orion was also a constellation apart from the place in mythology. And plans were that it would fly by 2014, at least in tests, which turns out actually came to pass despite a lot of changes in the program. So originally, before the Orion was going to be built, there was going to be another space vehicle called the Orbital Space Plane. And before that, there was going to be a different space vehicle that was unnamed, but it was going to be built by Lockheed Martin. That was going to be a suborbital space plane. So those were more like direct shuttle replacements than deep space spacecraft.
So just to clarify, I think what you said is pretty good, but can you clarify the difference between a spacecraft and a space plane?
Sure. Space plane tends to be suborbital or very low Earth orbit. So its altitude only goes out so far, maybe as a replacement for the shuttle program. It could also be a delivery system for smaller craft that would be piggybacking onto the suborbital plane. So you would have a suborbital plane take off, reach an extremely high altitude, and then you would have a second launch off of the plane of a smaller craft that would head into orbit. But those plans were scrapped, and the Orion was the new approach once that had happened. So in other words, there was a precedent already for planned aircraft getting canceled before it got to the full build-out stage. So there was no guarantee that Orion wasn't going to suffer the same fate.
Wow. So what's the Constellation Project going to do?
Well, it's not going to do anything now.
Because, what was it going to do?
Well, the one of the many...
As I should have said.
Yeah, one of the many plans was that they were going to send a return mission to the moon by 2020. They were also going to use the, under the Constellation program, there was a completion of the International Space Station planned in there.
Nice.
And also to extend human presence, quote, beyond our solar system, end quote.
That's pretty ambitious.
Yeah. I don't know if human presence necessarily means manned mission, though. Human presence may be, this was a man-made object that we sent beyond the solar system.
We're going to throw a ball really far.
Unless
they're working on warp drive or something, I don't think we're going beyond the solar system anytime soon.
Right.
But...
yeah, here's the but. The but is that the program, being incredibly ambitious, was also... it had problems, budgeting problems. There were a lot of issues. There were some political issues at NASA. I mean, it got kind of ugly in the mid to late 2000s. And by 2010, President Obama called for the end of the Constellation program, kind of to scrap the program and start fresh with a new approach, largely in light of new technologies and discoveries that had happened since they had started planning the Constellation program. So it was incredibly disappointing for a lot of people. Others, like I've seen some folks comment and say they felt that the Constellation program wasn't focused enough. And so they kind of thought, well, it was a terrible thing to happen to have this program scrapped, but it might have been the right thing to do. I was not in a place where I could comment on that one way or the other. Anytime any program for science gets canceled, I get a little sad. But at any rate, the development of the Orion vehicle continued. They decided that there were certain elements under the Constellation program that were worthy of continued funding. And one of those was the Orion spacecraft. Another was the Space Launch System, which will be eventually what brings Orion into space, a heavy lifting rocket.
Mm-hmm.
For now, we're using Delta IV rockets, but it'll be a different launch system further down the line. But that one's not ready yet. At any rate, the development of the Orion vehicle took place at the Johnson Space Center. And now it's called the Multipurpose Crew Vehicle, the MPCV, although most people just still call it Orion. And that's kind of where we're at now. Like, we're at the phase now where it went through all the design phase. It had been built out, and the test that we referred to earlier took place, which proved that the Orion systems are in fact spaceworthy, which is pretty cool.
That is super cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is super duper cool.
No, it's pretty.
I was very excited to see this thing tested.
I was too. I remember. So it was originally going to be launched on a Thursday morning, right? And then that Thursday morning, there was some weather issues.
There were some boats, I think, that were maybe kind of too close to the launch site that they were concerned about.
There was also a technical issue with the spacecraft itself. Some of the latches, they couldn't get a read on whether the latches had disengaged properly. So they essentially had to do a Control-Alt-Delete on the system. They really did reboot the system.
Yeah.
It was the equivalent of turning it off and on again. And they just could not get everything in line before the launch window closed, because there's only, like, in order for them to actually do the missions they have planned, they have to launch in very specific windows of time. So they had to scrap it for 24 hours. The next launch window opened at 7:05 a.m. on Friday morning, and that's exactly when they launched.
Mm-hmm.
They did not waste any time. So by the time I went to go and shoot my video about the Orion spacecraft, I already knew that the launch was successful, but I did not know if the splashdown would be.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We keep talking about this Orion capsule. Let's get into what's inside of it and what makes it go.
Yeah, sure. I was wondering how similar in the end it's going to be to the kinds of crew capsules we saw in the Apollo missions.
Well, certainly the exterior looks very similar, right?
Absolutely on purpose. In fact, the designers and engineers really wanted to mirror that familiar kind of nostalgic design that was used in Apollo, except, you know, update it with the modern materials and technologies that we have at our hands today.
Right, right. And I mean,
though some things on it are not quite as contemporary as you would think for interesting reasons, and we'll get to that later.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that, I mean, the Apollo spacecraft worked. It worked well. I mean, mm-hmm. the reentry into the Earth's atmosphere.
Well, like one time it didn't.
Well,
more than one time if we're going to be truly technical. Because Apollo 1 was a terrible disaster.
Yeah.
But that was a test flight that went terribly wrong. But the design of the craft was kind of elegant in its simplicity for the issue of reentry, right?
Yeah.
They had a specific design that allowed it to reenter the Earth's atmosphere in a specific orientation, and that was pretty remarkable. So
I should have also mentioned that it wasn't just that it, you know, looked real cute. It was also a very effective shape for a capsule to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you were to look at the launch of this, if you go back and watch the video and you take a look, and you see this rocket. It's got this tall, like tapered spire type cap to it. And you're looking for the Orion spacecraft, like the actual module. You're going to not see it because it is capped. It's kind of, think of it like a cap of a pen. The very top of the launch system is actually a launch abort system. Now, this is a device that is meant to help the Orion spacecraft escape if something were to go wrong at any point during the launch, even if it's on the launch pad itself.
Right.
So from the launch pad all the way up into when the separation would happen between the Orion, the service module and the rocket, right? So it's got its own set of thrusters. It's actually got three different motors on it. One is the jettison motor. That's just used to jettison the launch abort system from the Orion crew module, because eventually you're going to need to remove that cap if you want to do something like, I don't know, look out the window.
Uh-huh.
Because otherwise you're just going to see the interior of the launch abort system cap on there. So the jettison motor pulls the system away from the crew module once the two detach when they reach the proper altitude. Then you have the attitude control motor that allows for steering. So if you need to steer at all, you can use those. And then you've got the abort motor. That's specifically in the case of an emergency, which can propel the module away from the launch pad or just the launch delivery system. Should something really go wrong, it can deploy in milliseconds. So as soon as a problem is detected, and they've tested this out already, they've done tests of the launch abort system, they can activate it, the thrusters will fire, and they're pretty powerful. I mean, they can propel a crew up to a height of 1 mile at, and this is a quote from NASA, 42 times the speed of a drag race car.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'd say the average speed of a drag race car.
Yeah, NASA loves to use these analogies for the Orion spacecraft in general. They also said that it provides enough thrust to lift 26 elephants off the ground, but I don't know that they actually tested it.
Fat elephants or thin elephants?
Your average everyday... Every Joe elephant.
I was going to say, are we talking
African elephants?
I immediately went to like, is that an African or a European elephant?
Of course, the African elephants are non-migratory. We're going to get into a whole Monty Python thing now, folks. No, but at any rate, it is interesting that it has this very powerful abort system.
Well, that's important because we've seen space launches turn very tragic before.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting that it's one of the elements that NASA was very much stressing was an important part, which, you know, is kind of a departure from earlier launch abort systems, which were a little more rudimentary and not necessarily as effective. So, at any rate, once you get to the point where it detaches, that's important. You know, you can't have it on perpetually because that cap actually covers the part of the crew module where the parachutes would deploy. So you can't re-enter the Earth's atmosphere with that launch abort system on. It has to be able to detach from the capsule in order for you to be able to descend properly, to have a controlled descent.
Okay, I have another question.
Okay.
Let's assume you're an astronaut who's incredibly claustrophobic.
Okay.
It seems like you've gone into the wrong profession.
Not sure how you got through training.
How tight are the quarters in the new crew module?
Okay, so within the crew module, you have 316 cubic feet of space to move around in. That's about 9 cubic meters. It's not a lot. And it is a crew module that can hold up to 4 astronauts. So with a full component, crew component, you would have 4 people and 316 cubic feet of space. It's not a lot of space. You would be working in pretty close quarters for quite some time. Remember, this is a deep space
right,
capsule.
If you're going to Mars, you're going to be in a space this big for
8 months.
A better part of a year, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a long time to be hanging out in a small room with 3 other people.
They've got a ping pong table.
Yeah. So the bottom of the crew module itself, which, by the way, if you look at the animations of Orion flying through space, you're going to see that it has this extended area that's got a thruster on the back of it. That is the crew module and service module together. Eventually, those two separate. I'll talk about the service module more in just a second. But when they do separate, when it's time for the crew capsule to come down, the bottom of the crew capsule is where the heat shield is.
Yeah, the engineers actually redeveloped Apollo's heat shield material, Avcoat. It's a brew of like fiberglass and plastics, and this particular coating is on the Orion is designed to withstand temperatures up to some 5,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Toasty.
I don't have a translation for that for Celsius, but it's warm.
Yeah.
And that would be the reentry temperature for a return flight from Mars, for example.
Wild.
So, yeah.
And then if you were to look at the full component in the launch system, the bottommost part, the part that attaches to the rocket through an adapter, is the service module. Now, the service module was built, or it will, the finished one will finally be built by the Airbus Defense and Space Company. It was the one that we saw in the test flight was developed by the European Space Agency. Mm-hmm. So this was a partnership between NASA and the ESA. So ESA developed it, and then they've given the contract to Airbus Defense and Space to do the production for the later service modules. This is the part of the spacecraft that can hold unpressurized cargo. So you can think of it as like the cargo hold of the space shuttle. It's similar to that. It also supplies the crew with oxygen and water as long as it's attached to the crew module. Provides propulsion to move the spacecraft to proper orbits and course headings, etc. Provides thermal control to the crew. And it also generates and stores electricity. It has a solar panel array that it can deploy once you reach orbit or you head out.
Wherever you're going. Yeah.
Right. And that solar panel array is what will capture solar power and convert it to electricity for use on the spacecraft. And then once you're coming back for reentry, that's the part that gets jettisoned last, really, until that and the fairings around the Orion spacecraft as well. But all that gets jettisoned, and then the Orion manipulates, you know, is oriented so that the bottom faces the surface of the Earth when it starts to come back in. So that's kind of an overview of what the systems are. I've actually looked at some pictures, some mock-ups of what the interior of the spacecraft looked like. So when you're in a launch situation, you're laying flat on your back. And that's the position you would be in, although you're in a seated position because you're on a chair, but your back is on what would be the floor mm-hmm. in a world with gravity.
you're in a diaper change position.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in that position until you're able to unstrap once you're out in space, and then you can float around all willy-nilly where there is no real up or down anymore.
I guess they probably are wearing diapers, huh?
Yeah.
There's stories about it, yeah.
All the sexiness of being an astronaut, kids.
Yeah. Enclosed spaces with 3 other people that you're going to become real close friends with over the next several months to a couple of years, depending on the mission. So this is it's an exciting thing. It's interesting. We haven't had any manned flights, and that kind of brings us into what Orion is going to be used for. You mentioned one of them, Joe, the trip to Mars, although that one's further down the plan than other.
Right. Well, in the old regime, the Constellation program, they were saying we were going to, what, return to the moon in 2020?
Yes. The idea was that the moon was going to be our primary objective, and then from there, we would then start planning out trips to places like Mars.
Is that still basically the idea, or have we changed our mind?
Yeah. Kind of changed things around a little.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I think there's manned flights of it planned for testing around like 2021.
Yeah, that would be the earliest. And the crew module has a docking station where it can dock with other spacecraft. The Apollo spacecraft and Gemini spacecraft had these sort of things too. So it may be that we see other types of uses of the Orion in the closer future. But 2021 seems ambitious. A lot of people are saying that they doubt that 2021 is going to be when we see the first launches, not necessarily because of technological issues, but because of financial ones.
And politics.
Yeah. So we need to fund these. In fact, you could argue that the test flight was a test of two things: the spaceworthiness of the Orion capsule and NASA's ability to drum up excitement and enthusiasm for the space program.
Oh, yeah.
Both, I would say, were really successful.
Yeah.
If you were on Twitter on Friday morning when the spacecraft went up, you could not help but see tons of tweets about this.
Though, then again, I wonder if a lot of those were coming from the kind of people who are very interested in space anyway.
So sort
I
of
mean,
a...
What does it take to break through to the person who doesn't really... give a flip about space day to day?
I don't know what, I mean, apart from showing just the amazing videos and pictures that have been taken over the course of the space program, I'm not really entirely sure.
Yeah, that really is kind of the golden question there.
But
getting them
while they're young helps.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's part of it though, right? Because I mean, we're looking out several years. The people that who will be the astronauts in 2021, they're in school now, you know?
Yeah, well, okay, so as I was saying a second ago, the moon landing kind of did it. I mean, everybody cared about that. And I'm wondering, what's the thing we should put our feet on that'll get people really excited again?
Oh, well, the Orion project has moved away from the moon concept.
Yeah.
They're now talking about landing on an asteroid.
A captured asteroid.
That is so cool.
2025, I think, is the timeline they're thinking about if all else goes well.
And this would be, you know, for multiple reasons. One, I mean, we'd have a legitimate interest in asteroids and finding out their physical makeup, other things that we don't know that we don't know, right? I mean, there's stuff we don't know because we don't know.
I'm almost more excited about asteroids than I am about Mars. Asteroids.
They're a lot more cool.
They're a lot more
practical.
It's a pretty decent early arcade game, too.
That's also accurate.
Played it a lot when I was a kid.
That's science.
Yeah, so... So this would be kind of, instead of the moon acting as the stepping stone toward longer voyages, the asteroid missions would be in part beyond doing the basic science of testing the asteroid for finding out what its physical makeup is, all that kind of stuff. It would also be to test the actual capabilities of the Orion spacecraft in preparation for longer missions. And those longer missions would be the trip to Mars, which is an enormous goal. We have covered it many times on this podcast to talk about how big a deal it is to go to Mars. Because in order to just get there, you have to wait until Earth and Mars are lined up in their orbits so that you minimize the amount of time it's going to take to get from Earth to Mars. By minimize, we're talking still between 6 and 8 months, sometimes 9 months, depending upon exactly when the window is. Then once you get there... By the time you get there, Earth and Mars are no longer in that ideal alignment anymore. You're going to have to wait 2 years, more or less, until you get to those same conditions where you can make that same return trip from Mars to Earth and not require an enormous amount of fuel that I don't know where you would get it unless you're actually converting the raw material of Mars into fuel, which is a possibility. That's one of the other things they're looking into. So anyway, it's a huge, huge challenge. And the Orion is supposed to be the spacecraft that will get us there using NASA's approach.
Yeah, they're hoping that sometime in, say, the 2030s, that might be able to happen.
Yeah. And so contrast that with the Mars One colony plan to get people on Mars by early, like 2020.
What,
like
next
that?
Tuesday? Yeah.
Yeah.
They, sorry, that was overly dismissive. Perhaps,
yeah, I think we can be a little dismissive. I don't wish any project to fail. It just seems like that one is particularly ambitious.
It's hard to balance enthusiasm and a kind of motivating enthusiasm with being realistic.
Yes.
Because at the same time, you could have been living in the 60s and been super critical of Kennedy for setting the space timeline he did.
Oh, right. Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yet you could also argue that that ambitious timeline really did motivate us and our scientists to work harder and to be more inspired and to get it done.
The Cold War didn't hurt either. Yeah. The space race was a race. There was a it was a competition in many ways. And part of the issue may be that we feel like there's less pressure now. Like there's not this political reason to demonstrate our superiority of getting things really far from where they started.
Absolutely. I do think that that's valid. I would be more apt to be less cynical about the Mars One if they were choosing to fund it with anything but reality TV, which strikes me as goofy.
Even if you love reality television, the ability to raise enough money to send a mission to Mars, that would have to be the most successful reality television program ever.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Right? Because we're talking billions of dollars here. It's not cheap. So I thought it'd be fun also to talk about some of the other things that didn't really fit into the other parts of the podcast. And one of those is
fun facts about Orion.
Yeah. First one is fun fact. Hey, did you know radiation can kill you?
Yay!
Yeah.
Oh, wait, not yay.
No, it's
we talk
scary.
About this every time Mars comes up. Yeah. So, being on Earth is really nice because Earth is a big umbrella from all of the energy out there in the universe that wants to kill us.
It's also where I keep all my stuff.
Yeah.
Yay.
So if we're traveling beyond the protective barriers provided by Earth's magnetosphere and by Earth's atmosphere, we're in trouble, right?
There's some
high energy things out in space. There's solar radiation. Mm-hmm. There's cosmic radiation. There are cosmic rays. Mm-hmm. It's not good for you.
No, these are things that can cause some damage. Sometimes it can be severe damage, and you want to limit that as much as possible. So if you're on a multi-month mission to get to Mars, I mean, once you get to Mars, you still have to worry about radiation, but just the journey from Earth to Mars is going to be problematic. You've got to figure out how to protect the astronauts from...
Protect yourself with reality TV.
Now, in this case, you protect yourself with pretty much everything that's on board the spacecraft. The official policy or the procedure that you're supposed to follow in case the spacecraft detects radiation, then there are specific sensors on the spacecraft meant to detect cosmic radiation, solar radiation. You get an alert, and then everybody moves to the back. You all go to the aft section of the spacecraft.
It's sort of like getting into the cellar when the tornado's coming, except your cellar is protecting you with all of your food and water supply.
Right. Exactly.
Because you become the junk in the trunk.
Yeah, that's true. So you've got that heat shielding that Lauren talked about earlier. That's to your back, essentially, right? So that part can absorb quite a bit of radiation. And then you put everything in front of you that you can, like, the food,
chairs.
The water, chairs, exactly. You get your stuff. And the reasoning for this is that if you are already able to make use of things that are already aboard the spacecraft, you don't have to add more material and therefore add more weight
to the spacecraft.
Shielding. Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a jerry-rigged approach, but if it's effective, then it's awesome.
This is kind of similar to an approach we've talked about before for long space missions, which was the idea of using initially water and food resources as radiation shielding, and then as the mission goes on, using human waste as radiation shielding, which has high water content, and turns out that provides pretty good shielding.
Yeah, so it's essentially that methodology that they're talking about. Then there's also the part about what do you do, how do you get the capsule once it returns to Earth.
Right, because in the old days, I'm sure that you've seen footage from the old newsreels of Navy teams going out and like pulling the astronauts directly out of the capsule in the middle of the ocean onto lifeboats. No one really looking very excited about it.
Yeah. And this is not necessarily going to work for some of these longer missions where people have been outside of Earth's conditions for prolonged periods of time. Like going to the moon and back, that was several days. But if you're talking about going to Mars and back, that's like almost 3 years total. You know, in space and on Mars.
In microgravity. And...
yeah, Mars has 1/3 of Earth's gravity. So no matter what, you don't have the benefit of full Earth gravity while you're out there. And there's not a whole lot of room to put some exercise bikes on board this spacecraft. So there are real concerns about, you know, being gentle on the astronauts, making sure you have the safest way for them to get out of there. So once it splashes down, and we should also mention the splashdown thing is a boon. You might think, well, that seems primitive, but when you think about it, first of all, there's way more water on Earth than there is land. So that's that you don't have to go and pick out a specific runway for your ship to return to.
Yeah, if you're aiming for the Pacific, you've got a pretty good shot.
Yeah, so the window of reentry is way larger than it would be if you had to aim for a specific spot on Earth, right?
Right.
You've got a much larger area to play with. So once it splashes down, the Navy would go out to retrieve it, and first they would send out some various boats, either some rigid inflatable boats and some Zodiac-style boats, motorboats.
The teams are called amphibious specialists.
Amphibious specialists. So they're frogs.
Yes.
And if you're an amphibious specialist, and I just used a terrible term to describe you, I apologize. Some of my best friends are squids. So if you feel better, that's submariners. At any rate, so you go out, they go out there and they tow the spacecraft back to a Navy vessel, which has a well deck flooded. Now, this is something that can be accessed from essentially the ocean. The Navy team pulls the spacecraft into the well deck, which has water in it, and then the water is drained from the well deck. A platform is brought in, and then the astronauts are allowed to climb out of the capsule. And then they immediately go to a medical checkup. Like as soon as they are out, they go to be looked over by a doctor to make sure that they are in good health.
The Navy started testing this procedure around 2013 or so, and they found that it really is the safest thing for the astronauts and the most efficient process, the best use of the equipment that they have available.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so here's another thing.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that not everything on board the Orion is necessarily the most state-of-the-art equipment they could afford. In fact, in some cases, they might be looking back to an older technology to provide some of these vital systems on board the craft. Now, why would they do that? And what would they get that wasn't absolutely the newest thing they could get?
So the processor powering the Orion's computer system is probably what you're alluding to. It's IBM PowerPC 750FX, which for those of you who have been working with computers for a decade or more, you're probably familiar with the term PowerPC. Those were found in old Apple computers before they switched over and changed their processor types. The IBM PowerPC went on the market in 2002, and you're thinking it's 2014. Why are we using a processor that's older than a decade?
Well, the iPhone 6 sold out really fast.
Yeah, that was one thing. You know, that 6 Plus, everyone wanted one of those. They even had a docking station in the spacecraft.
No.
The real reason is because it's dependable. It's the reason you go with older technology is that you have a proven history of reliability. And the worry is that if you go with brand new technology, like the cutting edge stuff, the stuff that's just rolling out of Silicon Valley, it may not have that reliability. And what if people's lives depend upon the technology, you better make sure it's reliable. And that's the main reason. What's also kind of interesting about it is that there are multiple PowerPC chips. They have actually 3 computer systems on board that are all redundant. The reason being that if you encounter radiation, it could require that you reboot a computer system, and you can't go without a computer system even for just 20 seconds, which is how long the reboot process takes. So you have a backup system. But what if the backup system goes down? Well, then you have a third backup or a third system that acts as a second backup, I guess I should say. And the odds of all 3 systems going down, according to Geek.com, which talked about this extensively, are 1 in 1,870,000 missions. So the odds are low that you would lose all three systems.
But man, that one time.
1.8
million would be pretty rough.
I would like to think that by the time we start getting up to a point where statistically speaking, we'd be worried about that, we'd be using a different kind of spacecraft anyway. But at any rate, each computer system has two of these chips, and the chips aren't working like, you know, we think of multi-core processors. These are single-core processors, by the way. We think of multi-core processors as ways of taking complex tasks and dividing them up so that we can do them more quickly. That's not why the computer systems have two processors each. They have them so that they are both working on the same set of data at the same time and error checking each other. Hmm. If the findings are coming up different from one another, then they know they need to reboot that system because something has gone wrong with one or both processors. So it's kind of an early alert system for when you need to do a Control-Alt-Delete, which is kind of cool. Also, the equipment in general, like the circuit boards, the paneling, everything is much thicker than what you would find with terrestrial electronics. And again, that's to absorb some of this radiation before it has a chance to affect the electronic components. So very practical approach, which makes sense, right? And what's interesting to me is that if you look at the instrumentation panels, they look, you know, lots of physical switches, mm-hmm. lots of like oscillating kind of, you know, it looks like 1960s technology in a way.
Touch screen.
It's almost precisely the opposite of what you see in Elon Musk's Dragon capsule mockups, uh-huh. right? Where it looks more like an Apple product.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to see how NASA is taking this approach. They're saying, look, we want funding. And if we're going to get funding, we have to prove that this technology works. Mm-hmm. We don't have, you know, we are not a private organization. So we have to make sure that we can prove the things we say are going to actually be effective.
Yeah. And we want the most reliable things possible.
Yeah.
Even if they're less convenient than
it may not be as screen. It may not be as sexy mm-hmm. as the Dragon capsule, but just to me was interesting. Like if you compare the two, and you look at the interiors of both, how different they appear from one another. Also, you know, kind of on a similar note, I wonder if the private space industry is going to be an issue with getting funding for the Orion program. Simply because if I'm a politician and I'm presented with a proposal from NASA saying we need X billion dollars to fund this particular mission, and then I look over and I say, well, look, Elon Musk is over there at SpaceX doing it on his own dime and I don't have to spend anything, I worry that it's going to become a disincentive to fund the NASA program. I certainly hope that's not the case. I think we need both.
I hope that it's going to be more the case of both organizations working together and kind of helping each other out. You know, the sort of thing where NASA has rented a couple of its launch pads to SpaceX,
sure.
For example, and SpaceX has provided some equipment to NASA,
yeah.
and that they feed each other more like a friendly ice cream social in low gravity, and less of a competition.
And I don't think of SpaceX as presenting itself as a competitor to NASA. I'm just worried that people who are in charge of the wallets are going to see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just me being a little bit of a worrywart. Personally, I really hope that the funding comes through. I found the Orion launch to be incredibly inspiring.
Oh, I cry every time there's a launch. It's even if I'm not watching it, I just somewhere I feel it. There's a great disturbance in the force, and I just cry.
I also got a little weepy. Actually, I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to get through a video take without tearing up.
Oh,
but I did. Aww. I did. So yeah, there are two things I always tear up at: launches and lunches. So two things.
Oh,
yeah.
Lunch is pretty good.
Lunch is awesome. All right. Well, this was fun and, of course, very timely. I hope if you guys out there had a chance that you caught the Orion launch. There are videos, obviously, of the launch if you didn't get a chance to see it live. I didn't get a chance to see it live, so I watched the video after the fact. But very, very cool and really exciting stuff. If you have any suggestions for topics we should tackle in future episodes of Forward Thinking, why don't you send us an email? That address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line over at Google Plus or Twitter or Facebook. At Google Plus and Twitter, we have the handle fwthinking. Just search FW Thinking in Facebook. We'll pop right up. Don't forget to go see fwthinking.com. That's our website where we've got all the podcasts, videos, blog posts, other exciting stuff for you to check out there. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.